If You're Ready, the Staple Singers, and they were certainly a staple at Stax Records, which was established back in 1957, Memphis, Tennessee, as Satellite Records, and then they changed their name to Stax. And I've got a stack of Stax Records here, and we'll spin as many of those for you as we can tonight. Hey, ParanormalDate.com, man, it's just taken off. They are closing in on 59,000 members. And finally, a dating site to meet others with similar interests. It's free to join. You can use the code GEORGE for a sizable discount if you want to go further and get further involved. ParanormalDate.com. Remember, you are not alone. Recently released government files in Great Britain have revealed a spate of UFO police reports over the last few years. The documents, which were made available through the Freedom of Information request, detail how officers responded to calls from members of the public about UFOs over Lancashire, England. Three of these, one in which an object was reported over Lytham St. Anne's in 2014, and two others involving a craft over Pendle Hill in 2015, were investigated, but nothing unusual was found. An alleged alien abduction was reported in Burnley again in 2015, as well as two UFOs over Fleetwood. UFOs were also witnessed over Buckshaw Village and Bottle the year before. Despite efforts to investigate these sightings, however, officers came up empty each time. All right, back to more of my conversation with ufologist, New York Times best-selling author Bill Burns, plus your calls as we continue to discuss the Battle of Los Angeles, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with Bill Burns, New York Times best-selling author, ufologist, and we're talking about the Battle of Los Angeles, and we'll go to your phone calls momentarily. Let me just share an email I received. This was 2 days ago in anticipation of the show. It's from Dr. Andre. Late father was a block air raid warden, Glassell Park, California, a suburb of Los Angeles. He saw all this happening. A neighbor, an L.A. policeman, traded a piece of whatever was shot at for auto supplies. And he says, my father sold the same. Tested by a Dr. R. Leo Sprinkle, Ph.D., famed ufologist. And apparently the test proved it was pure magnesium. Well, Bill, have you heard similar reports, people claiming that they've got pieces of this craft that were shot at?
Well, I've got a piece of something. I think it's shrapnel. I don't think it's a piece of the craft. If this thing had been hit by those shells repeatedly, remember, it never changed course. It kept on going in the same direction, south, the whole period of time for two or more hours. It didn't flame out. It didn't explode. It didn't just get knocked out of the air. So the idea that something from the craft itself fell to Earth, again, knowing what people gathered from the beach, and as I said, I have a piece of it somewhere. It's a hard square, solid metal, very sharp on the edges. It's shrapnel. That was designed to blow apart a fuselage or a wing or an engine. So the idea that a piece of the craft fell down, I really can't go with that.
All right, let's go to the
falling apart.
Right. Wildcard line. John is in Omaha, Nebraska. John, good evening. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Good evening, Richard and Bill. Thanks for taking my call. In the late 1970s, I met a tall, young Japanese man who was here in Omaha for pilot training. And his father was a balloon pilot during World War II. And he said his father was very proud that he had bombed the U.S. mainland from his balloon during World War II. And it was a city somewhere on our west coast, and that's all I have.
Well, the Japanese did have these experimental balloon bombers. But I've read where those actually didn't come into full, they didn't deploy them until about 1944, 2 years later. What do you make of that, Bill?
Well, these were the fire balloons that the Japanese deployed. And you're right, they didn't do them at the outset of the war, but it was during the war, and they did land. I mean, and in fact, an interesting story about those fire balloons. One story was they were laced with anthrax, and that prompted the United States. So this is one story. That prompted the United States to engage in its own biological weapons program at Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah very early during the war. And in fact, if you drive near there, you'll see all the sensors for poison gas. So that was one theory about the balloon bombs. The other theory about them was they were just exploding bombs from balloons, some of which landed in places like Seattle and Oregon.
Yeah, they killed six people in Oregon.
What?
They killed six people in Oregon, balloon bombs.
Exactly. Yeah. And what the Army did, this is the interesting part about it, and this is why it's something today that's still talked about. What the Army did, what the War Department did, was they didn't acknowledge these explosions for two reasons. One, they didn't want to panic Americans to think they were under bombardment by the Japanese. But more importantly, what they didn't do was act as rangefinders for the Japanese balloon gunners. So the Japanese who were launching their balloons didn't know where the balloons were landing. The last thing that the War Department wanted to do was let the Japanese gunners know where the balloons were landing so they could make the adjustments in course and for wind to have them land in the same places.
Right, right.
That story of that cover-up of that, that it was never told, has two effects. Effect one was that was initially what was believed to have landed at Roswell in 1947, a Japanese balloon bomb. And that the Japanese balloon bomb didn't go off. The army didn't know what it was, and the next thing it was a UFO because that was harmless. Because the Japanese balloon bomb story was still top secret in 1947. So that was one theory of the case. Obviously, that didn't work because the balloon factory was right across from the base at Roswell, and B, the only real person who would have identified what that was would have been the base intelligence officer who had fought in World War II, Jesse Marcel. And the 509th was a strategic air command base. This was one of the bases where the atomic bomb was assembled for transport. So
exactly. They
would have absolutely known, they would have had that intelligence. So it wasn't a balloon bomb. But because of the wartime censorship, we couldn't say that it was a Japanese balloon bomb, even if it were. So the theory was that the cover story of a UFO was meant to cover up the real story of the top-secret Japanese balloon bomb. But the censorship of Japanese balloon bombs during World War II was so effective that story that I'm telling you is used in CIA training today.
Uh-huh.
For how news can be manipulated.
Interesting. I'd also read, Bill, that after the war, they questioned the Japanese, the military leadership over there, and they said they never launched any sort of an attack against Los Angeles.
They did say, but that was a lie. They did.
Okay.
And these were, in some cases, successful attacks.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies. Mark is in Baltimore, Maryland. Good evening, Mark. Welcome to Coast.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my telephone call.
My pleasure.
Mr. Burns, first of all, I want to say you're a pioneer, and you're a vanguard, and I've seen your UFO Hunters TV show, and I've read all your books, and I find them all fascinating.
Thank you.
Here's my question. This has to do with your book, The Roswell Encyclopedia, which, by the way, when I bought that, I read it from cover to cover. And, before I get to that, I would tell your listeners, all the listeners out there, when the day after Roswell came out, you know, that made the cover of Time magazine. And, of course, you know that, and I just put that out there for all the listeners in case they were interested in that. And that book was of such a great import that it made the cover of Time magazine. Anyway, back to the Roswell Encyclopedia. There was a part in there that it went along with the famous photo of General Ramey and Jesse Marcel holding up that fake wreckage, and in that photograph, General Ramey is holding what looked like message traffic in one hand, but part of that message traffic is exposed. And in your little article about that, you had indicated how people were trying to, you know, use the technology that they had at hand in order to decipher some of the verbiage in that message. And it did, some of the wording was occupants and craft and things like that. So my question, Mr. Burns, is has there been any progress on that? I mean, why, first of all, why would General Ramey hold something that's that, you know, critical out in the open like that so people could analyze it?
Well, two reasons, if in fact that's what that note contains. And I know the person who researched the photographs, he was a friend of mine. The one thing is that General Ramey never knew, how could he, that someday we would have the equipment to figure out what was in the telegram he was supposedly holding. So at the time, it was hastily prepared. They were whipping around equipment back and forth because the whole when you read Walter Hout's statement made in contemplation of death about what Jesse Marcel told him when he returned from Fort Worth the next day was that Ramey had asked Marcel to go into an anteroom, and when he came out, the actual material that Marcel had brought from Roswell was switched out for a weather balloon. And so it was very, very hasty, and they took the shot with Marcel smiling and said, gee, I guess I made a real mistake or something to that effect, with Ramey there holding a note, with Ramey doing it so quickly that he never even thought that 60 years in the future people would be able to decipher what was on the surface of that note.
Mm-hmm. Are you aware that Mr. Hout had made a deposition on his deathbed, and that was in the book Witness to Roswell by
Tom Carey and Don Schmidt? Sure.
Yeah.
That's
he
very, very important.
When Coast to Coast had Schmidt on there, I asked him that question, and Schmidt said he was in the room at the time. So I totally believe that.
Well, this was notarized. So unless you're mm-hmm. faking a notary signature, which is a felony in every state in the union,
yep.
This was, as Don explained, Don and our friends, as Don as I explains, that first of all, let's look at the document for a second. It's really an important document. The important part of it for me. Yes, it's great that Walter Hout was a first-hand witness to the crash, to the debris field at Roswell. It's great that Walter Hout had a piece of the Roswell crash debris on his desk. It's great that Colonel Blanchard indicated to him the height of the extraterrestrials on the gurneys that were being taken out, and great that he actually saw the craft under tarpaulins that was being moved along a country road on an Army flatbed. But we knew all that. The real import to me is the cover-up that Roger Ramey instituted the day before the material went to Fort Worth. In other words, Ramey flew from the 8th Air Force in Texas at Fort Worth down to Roswell, sat with the staff. They put the cover-up in place with the two Roswell crashes. Then Ramey flew back to Fort Worth. Marcel followed in that B-29 full of debris. Ramey, now get this, here's what he had to do. He had to get Blanchard compromised enough to, now this, if you've been in the military or know about the military, this is never done. You never have superior officers stepping into another's command. It's just not the way the military works. When Ramey compromised Marcel, he had to have done that with Blanchard's acquiescence. So when Marcel gets to Fort Worth, they switch up the equipment. He's making an officer in the United States Army, and this is what got Marcel so angry. He's making an officer in the United States Army look like a fool in front of the entire nation.
He had no idea what hit him.
Yes, that's really compromising Blanchard's command. Well, that so affected Marcel, according to Hout, that when Marcel got back to the 509th in Roswell, he refused to talk about it. He would never talk about it again when the Korean War broke out. 2 years later, Marcel went from major to light colonel. He would have been a full colonel by the end of the war when he retired. Why did he leave the Air Force at the start of a war when he was getting promoted to go to home in Louisiana and repair televisions? Why?
He'd been betrayed.
And why, when Jesse Marcel asked his father why you're doing this, Marcel, for the first time in their life, snapped at the kid. Now he's the late Jesse Marcel Jr., snapped at him and said, "We don't talk about that here, and don't you ever question me again." That was Marcel's response, Marcel Sr.'s response to why he left the Air Force at the start of the Korean War after he'd just been promoted. It made absolutely no sense. But when you see here, when you read about Walter Hout's description of Jesse Marcel's demeanor when he returned, he was a different person.
Sure, and understandably so.
Compromised by a superior officer made to look like a fool with his own commanding officer, Blanchard, acquiescing.
Mark in Baltimore, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Bill, let me circle back to the Battle of Los Angeles.
Sure.
It has been, would you agree that it has been overshadowed and that it doesn't maybe get the attention it deserves in terms of UFO coverage?
Absolutely.
And why is that?
Well, a couple of reasons. It occurred in the midst of a war, and it's very easy. It's like Foo Fighters. Why haven't Foo Fighters gotten more coverage? They've gotten a lot of coverage, but these events happen during a war, and there is kind of a fog of war. So nobody really first of all, the witnesses are now dead. But anybody really heavily investigating the Battle of Los Angeles comes up with the same questions that you and I have been going over for the past hour. And that is, what was the nature of the craft? We don't have any of it. We have the photographs. You can Photoshop the photographs, but you're Photoshopping multi-generation photographs from the Internet. What are you really Photoshopping? So that's a problem. You have these conflicting reports. You have the same weather balloon excuses at the Air Force, and now there's a new excuse that, it was a commercial plane, that this was the latest excuse. It was a commercial plane that everybody fired on. But a commercial plane being fired upon with 1,400 anti-aircraft shells exploding all around it and not hitting it, that's worse than if it were a UFO in the first place. It meant that we have gunners that couldn't shoot straight, and that whatever it was, a commercial plane with no defensive capability, kept on flying into the face of flak all the way south along the California coastline, impervious to heavy-duty anti-aircraft fire. It doesn't make any sense. So I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of what that is, but within 5 years after that event, we had the crash at Roswell. We had the Kenneth Arnold sighting.
Indeed. Let me jump in here, Bill. Pardon the interruption. Here's Linda Lindell from Stax Records again, taking us into the break with What a Man. Back on the other side, more of your calls. Bill Burns, The Battle of Los Angeles, Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. Otis, Shake, originally performed or recorded by Sam Cooke, written and recorded by Sam Cooke. In fact, this was the last song Sam Cooke recorded before his untimely death back in 1965. But this is Otis's version, and he makes it his own, certainly. Just a reminder, coming up at the top of the hour, The Memory Illusion with Dr. Julia Shaw. Our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, has posted some interesting videos in the carousel. Get on up to the website, coasttocoastam.com. An European Space Agency astronaut working aboard the ISS, International Space Station, has captured an incredible some incredible footage of two rarely seen weather events which have long puzzled scientists. Taking advantage of the unique perspective on the planet provided by the space station, an Andreas Morgensen was able to film phenomena known as red sprites and blue jets. The colorful electrical discharges which take place above storm clouds have proven to be difficult for researchers to study because they only appear for an incredibly brief period of time and in atmospheric locations that are hard to observe. As such, Morgensen's offerings from the International Space Station are perhaps the best view of the phenomena ever produced. And in the case of the blue jets, the first footage ever seen of the event taking place. And once again, you can see the video for yourself in the carousel at coasttocoastam.com. Eat and Greet, the luncheon series at the Great Greek Restaurant in Sherman Oaks, California. Your opportunity to break bread with George Norrie and some special guests. You can have fun at lunch, meet some of your favorite people in the world of the unknown and curious. Tickets go on sale, will go fast, rather, so reserve a spot now. What you do is you email your name and phone number to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. Then you'll be called back with details. Here's the lineup. Tuesday, Feb 28th, Lunch with George and Producer Tom. Thursday, March 30th, Lunch with George and Psychic Joseph Jacobs. And then Wednesday, May 17th, Lunch with George and the Beverly Hills matchmaker, Marla Martinson. The Eat and Greet Luncheon Series at the Great Greek Restaurant in Sherman Oaks, California. All right, back to more of my conversation with Bill Burns, the Battle of Los Angeles, and your calls when Coast to Coast AM continues in mere moments. And we are back with Bill Burns. Bill, before we get back to the phone calls, tell us about the new book, Edison versus Tesla.
Well, it's coming out shortly. Folks can look for it on Amazon and pre-order it. It is, the basic premise of the book is that Edison's very last invention that he was trying to perfect was, and so was Tesla, they were in a race to perfect this, was a telephone to talk to the dead. It was Edison's spirit phone. And that's been kind of a myth. That's been kind of shrouded in history. People say, oh, it never really happened. Other people say, yes, it did. And so what my co-author Joe Martin and I decided to do was basically research this ourselves. We did. And years ago, I was working with the Edison it was the Edison Monument in Menlo Park, New Jersey, and we have all these files. And it was, we were doing the Edison Encyclopedia. And this very last invention was spirit phone. And so one of the things that troubled us was the question, why would a person who basically not only invented the 20th century, but invented the 21st as well, why would he be doing a phone to talk to the dead? Here was a guy who was an electrical engineer, a scientist. Why would he be dabbling in basically what people saw as the occult? So we went through his records, and if you look in his own journal, there is nothing about this invention. Then we found out that a whole portion of that journal was excised by Edison's family after his death.
They were embarrassed by it.
A copy of that turned up in France, and we published that now in this book. And it's basically Edison talking about his theories of life, the afterlife, life units, essentially how extraterrestrials came to Earth. This is Thomas Edison talking now. This is his journal.
That's quite a find.
It is. So when you apply that to when Edison was developing this, he was developing this in the 1920s, and he actually had a demonstration of this device. Didn't work, but we had a demonstration of this device. We don't know why it didn't work, whether the device itself was flawed, whether there were no dead people there, no spirits there, or whether his whole theory of what happens after we're dead. But here's the fascinating thing about that. Edison's theory about how life units, how the essence of our personalities continue after death, comports with that current theory being developed at the time in the early part, in the early half of the 20th century, on quantum entanglement and spooky attraction. That's what Einstein called it. It deals with quantum theory, Max Planck's theory. It deals with Heisenberg's theory. And it's an exciting to see Edison looking at that science circa 1920 and coming up with a theory about an invention based on that science of cohesive electronic particles that exist not separate from the body, but can exist after death as a cohesive unit, maybe being some sort of consciousness. Well, when you think about that, that's the whole basis of the modern television show Travelers.
Right, right.
Your consciousness is beamed into another living body after that body is dead so as to inhabit it. That's the purpose of Travelers.
And what about Tesla? Because he was notorious for not writing things down. So what did you find with Tesla in this device?
He kept a journal.
Ah.
And in that journal, he's talking about people spying on Edison because they were in a race. See, Tesla thought something different. Tesla's idea, which is proven to be true, absolutely true, is that waves, frequency waves, are eternal. In other words, if our conversation going over the radio right now, that is going to head out into space. So if you're an extraterrestrial a billion light years away, since our sound waves are now traveling at the speed of light, in a billion years, that person will hear our conversation. So Tesla thought, if that's the case, then there must be radio frequencies of the dead, of spirits departed, that might still exist. All we have to do is find the right frequency. And that's what he was experimenting with. Remember, Tesla eventually was awarded the patent for wireless radio transmission. He beat Marconi in that. And so he was the father of radio, along with Marconi to some extent. But Tesla argued that if you could find the right frequency, then you will be able to tune in some sort of listening device, a radio, on voices of the dead. So there are these two great inventors of their age. One, Tesla, died in 1943, Edison dying in 1932. But they both were looking at the same thing, how to connect with the dead. And so Joel and I were thinking, well, okay, we know the science of the period. We know that we covered this blending of the great age of spiritualism from the latter part of the 19th century right through the age of science at the beginning of the 20th century, and how science was, in the early part of that century, 100 years ago really, was devoted to looking at the unseen as a way to explain the seen. So you had radio waves. You can't see them. You could hear them with a certain device. You had, in medicine, Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung. They're talking about things that are unseen. They're in subconscious mind manifesting themselves as physical symptoms, physical traumas. Then you have the work of Einstein and Planck talking about the unseen world of the atom and bits of quanta energy, but they control the way we exist. That was the background for both Edison and Tesla coming into this field in the beginning of the 20th century.
Sounds like a brilliant premise for a book, Bill. Can't wait.
That's the book.
Great premise. Great premise. Let's go back to the phone calls. Wildcard line, Mike is in Glasgow, Montana. Mike, good morning, good evening. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Good evening, gentlemen. I just have one quick question. I'll take the answer off the air. Bill, in your opinion, how are UFOs getting here?
Well, I think they are here. I mean, I don't think that. Well, there are a number of theories. Okay, let me just, instead of giving you a flip answer, it's this. One, when people talk about the vast distances between star systems, right, millions of light years, and people traveling back and forth, why would they come to Earth? Well, one theory is that let's just say that you cannot only control space, but you can control time. So let's argue one of the theories of hyperlight travel. You don't just travel through space. You drag space and time across you. So if you have a very powerful reactor that can actually take space, create, let's say you're creating a black hole, or something akin to a black hole. In other words, space-time will fall into that singularity. If you can manipulate that in terms of an engine, it's not a propulsion engine now because you're not pushing against empty space, you're basically bringing space to you. Well, if that's the case, maybe you can chart a course across stars and things that might be billions of light years away are nothing more than ours because you can bring space-time to you across you. That's one theory of space travel.
That's
another theory is they're not traveling back and forth. They're already here. They're under the ocean. They're UFOs, the USOs.
Right. And
so
if that type of flying saucers
here.
That type of propulsion system, if they have it, again, to circle back to the Battle of Los Angeles, that would explain why they had no need to fire back, because you know we threw everything we had at this object back in 1942, the shells just bounced off of it and it didn't fire back, Bill. It didn't fire back. It saw no need to. I mean, we're just like it would liken us to ants, I'm sure.
That explains a lot of things, because in addition to the Battle of L.A., they think they can see something there. There's an image that's pinned in their searchlights, but the object is traveling inside of an electromagnetic envelope, pulling space-time across, maybe very slowly, so that it's not even in this reality, in this time frame, for them to shoot at. So they could fire right at it. And it's as if it's not there. This conforms to other things that we learned on the UFO Hunter show, where a UFO will pass over a police car. The engine stops. The radio goes dead. They're static. It happened to Rex Heflin in 1965. The radio stops, goes dead. Then suddenly the object passed overhead and is gone, and the engine starts up again. Now, that bothered me. Because when I heard those stories from the police who saw this, I said, gasoline engines don't just start up when they stall. You have to turn the key to start the electricity, right, so that you could have combustion in the engine,
right.
And the engine starts.
Right.
So if the electricity is cut off, you have to turn the electricity back on. It's not spontaneous. Yet these police cars started spontaneously. Why? What if the engine was never shut off? What if what passed over the police car was an object out of that particular time frame? So what that officer and that police car experienced wasn't being shut off, but literally they were in this envelope where they were out of time. So theoretically, it was between beats of that combustion engine. When the object passed, time returned to normal on the engine.
That's a brilliant analysis. Let's go to the wild card line. Patty is in Bellevue, Washington. Hi, Patty.
You know, it has been so exciting to me in these recent years to find that when I sat on the porch in Inglewood, California that February and watched that thing, that was a UFO, and I didn't even know it. But, of course, I didn't see that it was a UFO. I just kept looking for the airplane. Where's the airplane? I was 11 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw all the puffs of smoke. I saw the searchlights, and I sat there for a long time until they caught me and found that I had gone out from underneath the big oak table where air raids make us go.
So,
great story, Patty.
Yeah, Inglewood, California.
I know where that is. So you were back a little bit from the beach itself.
Oh, yeah, but not far.
Okay.
Hermosa, Redondo, all of them were real close.
Did you see anything in the searchlights?
No. I couldn't see any airplanes. I kept thinking, where's the airplane? There have to be airplanes up there.
Now, in between the thundering of... Now, you heard the artillery going off, obviously.
Patty, did you hear the artillery?
I remember seeing the puffs of smoke.
Okay, and you heard it. And was the ground shaking for you a little bit?
Nope.
You just saw the puffs of smoke and the searchlights.
Yeah, a lot of them.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's
anyway,
wonderful.
Thank you for telling me it was a UFO. That's
my witness. Yes, it was a UFO. You were not crazy. There was something there. You just didn't see it. Yes.
Yeah.
There you go.
Thank you.
Patty, thank you for that.
70 years?
75 years ago.
75 years.
Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patty. Mel is on the wildcard line in Saskatoon, Canada. Hi, Mel. You'll be our last call.
How's it going there tonight, gentlemen?
Very well. Thank you.
Good. So, listen, this is a story about your unknown creatures.
Oh, that was last night, I think, Mel.
I'm sorry. I thought it was tonight. I heard tonight.
Well, we talked about bipedal canine cryptids last night.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
With Lon Strickler. But tonight we've got Bill Burns talking UFOs.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought it was about the cryptids because I just heard it tonight. So maybe
all right.
I live up in Canada. Maybe it's that delayed show then.
You may have heard the replay. Sorry about that, Mel. All right, we are running up against the clock here, Bill. Again, the new book, Tesla versus Edison, and that's going to be available when?
That should be available probably for pre-orders. Actually, in a few weeks, folks can get it. Folks can pre-order it. Folks will be able to get it electronically as well. It'll be on Amazon. Yeah, it's being published by Skyhorse.
And what else is going on with you, Bill? What are you working
on? I'm finishing a manuscript right now. Which is called Paranormal Presidents, and it's basically all the presidents, UFOs, and ghosts. And that's coming out later on this year in October, and that's going to have some pretty startling things in it, I have to say. Some pretty startling. What I'm doing is we're looking at the history of the American presidency from before there was a president, from George Winthrop, who was governor of Massachusetts, Massachusetts Bay Colony in the 17th century, from that first officially recorded UFO sighting in the New World, north of Boston, in the Charleston River, on the James River by Charleston, from there all the way to the apocalyptic vision in the current White House, and why that is so interesting in light of other apocalyptic visions, because it's paranormal and UFOs. We're combining them in the same book. But
right,
they're literally blockbusters. We solve a couple of things. One, we talk about the murder of Marilyn Monroe because she was blabbing JFK's pillow talk secrets. She threatened to blab it to the press. So she had to be knocked off, and we've identified that. We talk about the Kennedy assassination, his last memo about UFOs to the CIA. We talk about the Lyndon Johnson reaction to the crash at Kecksburg. We're talking about Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter as UFO presidents. Ronald Reagan's own daughter, Patty Davis, told us that Ronald Reagan was very enthusiastic about UFOs.
Sounds like another winner, Bill. Can't wait. Thank you so much for the last 2 hours. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Bill Burns, The Memory Illusion, Why You Might Not Be Who You Think You Are. When Coast to Coast continues, and here is all-night worker Rufus Thomas, Stax Records, taking us into the break. Stay with us.